Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New Year's Eve in Beebe, Arkansas, came with a mystery. The morning after, the streets of Beebe were covered with dead blackbirds, 5,000 or so, battered and dead. In an instant, of course, the whole world knew and wondered what had happened. It looked Hitchcock or an act of God. The answer may be more simple, but it's still fascinating. This hour on Point, the life and death of birds, starting in Beebe, Arkansas. You can join the conversation. What did you make of the news? 5,000 birds down in a stroke. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And later this hour, the researcher who famously linked autism to vaccines is called out as a fraud. We'll look at that. But first, to blackbirds, here's a whole bunch of red-winged blackbirds. Yeah, sounding pretty good, but here's Milton McCuller, Beebe Town Street Supervisor, talking to local television station KATV about what happened on the morning of January 1st.
I thought the mayor was messing with me when he called me. He got me up at 4 o'clock in the morning and told me he had birds falling out of the sky.
And here's Charles Moore of Beebe, Arkansas. Birds falling out of the sky, here's what he woke up to, a surprise on his front lawn that morning.
Went out to get the paper, and I looked and I said, wait a minute, what is this? And there were birds all over. We probably had 14 or 15 just in the front yard.
And on they went in their thousands over streets and lawns and rooftops. Joining us now from Humphrey, Arkansas, is Karen Rowe, Bird Conservation Program Coordinator in Wildlife Management at the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. Karen Rowe, thank you very much for being with us from Arkansas today.
You're welcome.
With us from Washington is Greg Butcher, Director of Bird Conservation for the National Audubon Society. Greg Butcher, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Ithaca, New York, Kevin McGowan, ornithologist and researcher at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, looks at the social behavior of birds. Kevin McGowan, great to have you with us as well.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be here.
This is a great crew, so help us dive in and understand what happened here and maybe a little more broadly as well. Karen, give us the latest on what the thinking is on what went on that night, the night of New Year's Eve.
What we believed happened was the birds, we have reports of them going to the roost as usual at between 5 and 6 p.m., and then we also have a report from an individual who said that actually he thought there were more birds in that roost that night. He stood out in his yard while his children were playing and watched them, and he thought there were a greater number of birds than typically using that roost.
Yeah.
We had several individuals report that there were fireworks, the legal small bottle rockets and such that are sold at local fireworks stands.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a report from the police chief that at approximately 10 p.m. he heard a series of 10 to 12 very loud booms that he believes came from what he thinks is a commercial type or professional type firework. He said these booms were loud enough to rattle his windows.
That somebody had gotten a hold of and they had pulled it out to celebrate New Year's Eve.
Yes, I believe that the folks up there were definitely trying mm-hmm. to celebrate the coming of the new year. And shortly thereafter, about quarter after 10, people went outside because they heard these booms, were curious as to what was going on. And we have several individuals who reported hearing the whoosh of the wings of the blackbirds, but saying that they were a lot louder than normal, and then observing the blackbirds not flying above the treetops as normal, but instead flying at rooftop level. And then they reported shortly after realizing that the birds were very, very low, hearing them crash into mailboxes, houses, vehicles.
I'm looking at Mike Overstreet here in Beebe, resident there, who said, you know, he went out and he saw just birds everywhere, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds scattered across the ground. The oak tree across the street from his house in Beebe looked like a giant net full of birds. He said so many birds in it, it was unreal. A lot of them running around with broken wings, those on the ground, broken wings, broken legs, other injuries. And by morning, he said a bunch of them were gone. Karen Rowe, what's the range of things you considered when you first got this news?
Well,
what did you look into?
When I first got this news, it was 15 minutes after midnight,
oh,
and I have to say I was rather shocked. Talked to our wildlife officer, and the first thing I said is we have to collect samples. We have to collect birds for necropsy because in any type of mortality event, the birds are going to themselves, their bodies will hold the answers. In talking to folks and sifting through all the information we've gotten, blackbirds do not see well at night. Most of the people who, the professionals who try to move roosts by scaring them, know that they don't like to move at night, and they use pyrotechnics usually to flush blackbirds from the roost. But whatever happened that night obviously was so loud that it disturbed the birds, and we're theorizing that with the local fireworks, the kids shooting off bottle rockets, that the birds avoided that, and by not going high in the air where these other normal fireworks are, they flew in flocks at lower levels than they are accustomed to and crashed into structures that are normally not in their way.
We want to hear from our ornithologist and our Audubon bird expert as well. We've got callers, though, from Arkansas, BB, Arkansas, where it happened. Charles Moore is on the line. Hi, Charles. Thanks for calling. What did you see?
Thanks.
Sure.
Well, my backyard borders the area and the line of trees that these thousands of birds typically roost in. And as I indicated, and I think I heard a clip of my voice even on your program earlier, I got up that morning and we had probably 30 to 35 birds berthed both in the front yard and backyard. Wow. And then you look down the street and it looked like a war zone here. And I guess our first thought was that, you know, and you wouldn't want to charge anybody, accuse anyone of anything,
okay,
but these birds have been poisoned. I mean, you know, not knowing much about birds.
Is there precedent for that in your neck of the woods,
no,
Charles?
No, I don't think so. The birds have been pests for the last 3 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the neighbors here are really, you know, my first thought was someone got tired of the mess, you know, and the thousands of birds and the
everything drop. They leave behind, yep.
Yes, yes. And that was my first thought. Mm-hmm. Someone decided to take care of it. First thought was the city did something,
mm-hmm,
and then I found out they didn't. So next thought was some individual must have taken this into his own hands.
But now they're saying fireworks. Do you buy that? Karen, sure. Karen Rowe.
We have tested for a wide array of organophosphate and carbamate pesticides, and the tests have come back negative. We are testing for a few starlicides or avicides that are also used. But the birds did not have any food in their digestive tracts or in their crops, which would indicate that they weren't feeding on something that would have contained a poison. And their bodies are obviously showed signs of trauma, showed collisions with objects. And I'd like to let the citizens of Beebe know we're still looking for things, but we really don't feel that there's any threat of it having been a poisoning event.
Charles, in Beebe, fireworks, a scare, and a kind of a freak-out panic flight. What do you think?
Well, that's good to know about the poison, and I believe what she's saying. I guess I'm going to have to go with, you know, there's been several theories presented here, but this theory of the birds maybe getting disoriented during the night because of a commercial-grade firework going off.
Yeah, big boom. Yeah.
You know, I think I'm going to have to go with that, although we've had fireworks in the previous years, and we've never had it, but it doesn't mean it didn't happen this time.
Charles, I'm glad for your call from BB, Arkansas. I want to take this to our ornithologist and beyond, but one more here first. From Columbia, South Carolina, Wayne looks like a pretty interesting caller. Hi, Wayne, you're on the air. What have you seen?
Thank you. Yes, as I mentioned before, I was stationed at Barksdale Air Base, not too far south of BB, in 1967, and
okay,
it was during cold weather. It was about this time of year,
mm-hmm,
and I was working the main gate, and we had birds start raining down out of the sky, dead and dying, and it was a really a bizarre situation. But
how did you explain it? Did you ever figure out why, Wayne?
Well, the air base, Strategic Air Command base, said they thought that it was radar had caused it.
Radar maybe knocking birds out of the sky. Well,
right,
we'll put that to our gang as well. Wayne, I appreciate your call. All right, Karen Rowe, please stand by in Arkansas. Greg Butcher, Kevin McGowan in Ithaca and Washington. Let's get your thoughts. I know red-winged blackbirds well, grew up with plenty of them around. Not this kind of number by any means. I thought they were always a great-looking blackbird with that nice sort of bright chevron on their shoulder. Kevin McGowan, you're quoted in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette saying that this almost never happens. It's a very strange thing. What do you make of it?
Well, Anytime birds die in huge numbers, it's rare enough that we want to know why. Like your caller said, typically the first thing we think of is poisoning, because that usually is a case. But this was interesting because there were so many birds falling dead more or less at the same time in people's yards that you couldn't ignore that.
Running into their mailboxes and the bumpers of their cars and all.
That is definitely not normal red-winged blackbird behavior. Again, I sort of go with the dazed and confused theory as well, but this isn't that normal a thing that we can just give a pat answer to it. It's like, oh, yep. No, yeah, I mean, it's obviously it was cause A. Every one of these mass killings is mass deaths is an individual case, and they have to be looked at individually. And as Karen said, the data are there, the bodies are the evidence, and we can make a lot of theories, but. And this is the fun of science, is that there's evidence that we can actually find out what's right and what's wrong.
Greg Butcher, we've just got half a minute before the break. We'll hear more. But how rare is this for 5,000 birds to fall out of the sky?
Well, I read an article today saying that it's really common, and then they cited 12 instances over the last 100 years.
That's not so common, if that's what it is.
That sounds pretty rare to me, and we just don't see this sort of thing very often.
There it is, alive and healthy, male red-winged blackbird. But as everybody knows, in BB, Arkansas, New Year's Eve, 5,000 went down, and they went down fast. We're talking with Karen Rowe this hour from the Game and Fish Commission in Arkansas, Greg Butcher from the National Audubon Society, and Kevin McGowan from Cornell's Lab of Ornithology, looking at the 5,000 birds that dropped dead in Arkansas and the way birds live and die now. A little later in this hour, we're going to look at the news out of England about apparent fraud in the research that went into connecting vaccines and autism. But right now, it's birds with a pretty great panel right here. Tom in Andover, Connecticut, what's your question?
Yes, hi. Hold on one second.
Sure.
I'm okay. Please stop me. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually pulled over on the road. Just a quick question.
The police, okay. They can come first if they need to.
I'm not driving. I'm on the cell phone. I'm not driving.
Okay,
so
okay.
Good. I was just wondering, fireworks have been around all my life. They've only gotten more available and stronger.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just wondering, why is this not happening more often? I mean, every year around the 4th of July, New Year's. And a quick comment, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's another reason to not have fireworks. You know, the noise, the expense, I like the noise, and the aligned the alignment with patriotism. So I'll take my... your answer.
Okay, Tom, good luck with the police there in Andover, Connecticut. I don't know, Kevin, let me come to you. Is there something about blackbirds in particular, their roosting behavior, their finickiness when it comes to loud booms? Are they more susceptible than other birds? Something in their social behavior that would have, I mean, all birds, if, you know, everybody's sort of clapped their hands and seen the flock of sparrows go. Is there something about blackbirds that makes them particularly vulnerable here? And you hear Tom saying, you know, fireworks go off all the time, but we don't always see birds dropping dead en masse.
Well, it's a good point. And I would say that, no, red-winged blackbirds aren't scared of things any more than any other bird. The biggest difference is they get together in bigger numbers. And so when you see, you get a stampede of red-winged blackbirds, it's bigger than a stampede of sparrows. But to answer the question about why, you know, 4th of July, that's a very logical question, because there are an awful lot of fireworks that go off then.
Sure.
But the difference is that the red-winged blackbirds are spread out across the landscape at that point. They're actually trying to breed and make a living, and they don't want to be near another blackbird. They want to keep their own territory and keep everybody away.
In the summertime, they're clustering up in the winter for warmth?
That's
right. Is that
the thing? Well, for a number of reasons they cluster up. They start to get together once breeding's over. They form big flocks before they migrate to the south. And then in the south, they sleep together in these giant numbers, and they go off and find food together. The basic ideas for these type of things are mostly boil down to safety in numbers, to safety from predation, and to share information about food. That is not necessarily that I'm going to tell you where food is, but if you're hungry and you're in the midst of all of this and you watch the guys head out in the morning looking determined and happy, you follow them and then you find the food there.
Greg Butcher, what about noise in birds? We know birds have been up against a lot of challenges. I mean, a century ago it was really bad. It may be better now, but there's a lot of noise out there in the world now. It's not all fireworks scale, but how big an issue is noise for American bird populations?
Well, I'd say noise isn't the biggest issue that the birds face, but that you do have to worry about the collisions. So it's the fact that there's so many structures near where these birds are roosting that really proved fatal in this case. I mean, if they'd been out in an area that was otherwise pristine, they'd have heard the noise, they'd have flown up from their roost, and they probably would have crawled their way back to it in their half sleep. But the fact that there's so many buildings and cars and mailboxes to collide with, it just means that people and humans, you know, kind of run into problems that way.
We've got eyewitnesses saying that they saw a lot of, you know, birds pretty beat up on the ground, but by the time dawn came, a bunch of them had managed to straggle their way off again, you know, get up and fly again. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, they can survive. A lot of times, you know, people see a bird hit their window, they put it in a box, and they seem to recover. Unfortunately, what we find out is most of those birds tend not to survive, you know, more than 24, 48 hours. So that kind of a trauma is usually deadly to birds, even if it's not immediate.
A couple more callers here. Lexington, Kentucky. George is calling. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Yes. Yes, I wanted to say that it just strikes me as... It's unlikely that a fireworks would bring down birds. And I'm thinking logically here that, you know, these birds are flying in the atmosphere, and it seems to me that some atmospheric disturbance, so like a sudden shift in wind direction or even maybe a lightning discharge.
But at that time of night, as Kevin's saying, they should have all been clustered up in the roost. But maybe once they got going, Karen, how about it? Did you look at, I mean, people asked about lightning. George asked about wind shear. What about it, Karen?
Well, we're looking into a variety of those factors, but I really don't understand how what atmospheric conditions. We have radar information that show that it was a relatively calm time of night.
Okay.
And the radar actually shows the bird roost at about a little bit after 10. The radar images, the Doppler radar, shows the bird roost coming into the sky over Beebe. And even though the raining, so to speak, of the dead birds seemed to stop after about midnight, Doppler radar still shows bird reflectivity in the air up until almost the middle of the morning, or about 4 a.m.
Do they always roost in the same place there around Beebe, Karen? Do you know, or does it move? Does it move every evening? How's that work?
Generally, it's the same place.
What kind of place? A big tree in somebody's backyard, or along a hillside, or
it's a small woodlot. When you take 5,000 or plus birds. It takes a small woodlot and an area for them to roost in, and they have been, the USDA has moved this roost before, tried to scare it to areas where it wasn't so close to people in years past.
We've got April here saying online she thinks it's a supernatural statement. I know a lot of people had that first reaction. JW, Grand Rapids, Michigan. JW, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering, one of the previous callers mentioned fireworks, and, you know, I agree with him that, you know, we've had fireworks for eons, and well, not eons, but you know what I mean. But you know, we've never had any kind of death kill off like this. My immediate thought was that this might be BP related, not the British Petroleum.
You mean the Gulf oil spill?
The Gulf oil, right? There might be some contamination that, you know, maybe they're not telling us about, and I'm hoping that somebody will do an independent test and find out, you know, what their the birds' migratory patterns are, find out what the toxicology, you know, what
or wind patterns and the burn off. Yeah, let us hold that thought. That's interesting, JW. I appreciate your call on that. And let me get one more right here, if I may. We will pick that up. But one more, Dave in Northfield, Vermont. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if anyone had brought up the Pine Bluff Arsenal sarin/mustard gas leak theory on your show yet. I've been reading it on the internet.
I don't know anything about that. What is that at Pine Bluffs, Dave?
It's an arsenal that's been incinerating nerve agents, and they're just in the process of cleaning it up. And some people have thought that they may have had a mustard gas leak from their storage facility, which is actually pretty common in these storage facilities. And according to, like, wind direction from NOAA and stuff, both BB and the Louisiana bird kill were downwind in opposite directions a few days apart from this facility. And I've heard a lot about it on the Internet, but haven't heard it in any media yet, and was wondering if
well,
folks had any thoughts on that.
It's very interesting. Internet gets a lot of stuff going. Let us pick it up. Karen Rowe, there's two. One, the possibility of burn-off from the Gulf oil spill. And here, I don't know, the Pine Bluff Arsenal and burning nerve agents. Have you looked at those? Do you know anything about those, Karen?
Well, this is where the value of the necropsies comes in because, like I mentioned earlier, the bodies of the birds are going to hold the answers. They will let we are testing for a great wide variety of chemical agents, toxins, and this is being conducted not just by one lab but by three. So if any type of exposure to chemical substances has occurred, they will show up in these tests in the birds' bodies.
There was another big die-off in Louisiana, not long after yours, right down in Pointe-Coupee Parish, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. People are saying power lines there, but I don't know. Kevin, you're listening here. What about it on the, you know,
well,
autopsies should tell us all, I guess, as long as we learn.
Well, that's just it. And again, this is why I'm a scientist, is this is fun stuff because you can tell these things apart. You can get answers because each of these ideas, each of these hypotheses of what happened make predictions about what you should find in the bird bodies. And if it were gas, you would expect these birds to fall dead, both one in the roost, not out flying, and there were no birds in the roost. It was all out across the landscape. You would expect those birds to be relatively intact without all of the broken bones and blunt force trauma things that they found. So all of these things actually are testable. And it sounds like Karen's group is doing a great job of actually looking for the right answers. I know the biology of the birds, and so I can place those things in and say, okay, nope, that one doesn't make sense because of A and B and C. But as she says, the bodies hold the answer. And in Louisiana, yeah, power lines make sense because you have to understand these birds get together in unbelievable numbers in the winter. I mean, we're talking a million birds in a flock sometimes.
Wow.
And
in
if
a
you
single
try to
flock,
fit, say,
is that like one roost of a million birds?
Right. Yep. And during the day, you can see these things across the landscape. I mean, a million birds is the largest single event recording we have from our project eBird that tracks bird populations across the U.S. in real time. And the largest single report from Arkansas was in December of 08 with a million birds in one spot.
Great.
So when you try to fit a million birds under a power line, you can imagine they don't fit.
No.
Some of them actually run into it, and there is a chance of having accidents like that.
Greg Butcher, people get focused and skeptical in a hurry, though, because we also had in this last week that big fish kill down in Louisiana, 100,000 fish, or this is, I guess, in Arkansas, in a 20-mile section of the Arkansas River, 100,000 drumfish. But let's stick with birds, Greg. The chemical threat to birds in this country these days, back in the DDT day, it was huge, and they died in huge numbers. What about now? What is the environmental sort of profile of chemical threat for birds in the United States?
Well, there's still a very wide use of pesticides. The productivity of agriculture needs to be unbelievably high, and so many pesticides are being used. And there's new pesticides coming online every day. So the long-acting pesticides like DDT have been taken off the market, and the ones that we use today tend to be very quick-acting. But they do kill birds and other wildlife, and so the threat of pesticide death is always with us.
Larry in Prospect, Tennessee. Thanks for calling. You're on the air, Larry.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I wanted to go with the explosion causing maybe an inner ear rupture in the bird, somewhat like when we get inner ear infection, our equilibrium is off.
Yeah.
Can this happen in the birds as well?
Good question. Kevin, would it need to be that serious? Inner ear, you know, it's like burst the eardrum if they have an eardrum. I don't even know. Or just panic and freak out.
Well, certainly if the explosions were right near there, that's possible. These birds clearly were disoriented, scared, confused, disoriented, and doing things they shouldn't have been doing. So sure, that's always a possibility that there are other factors involved there. Again, Karen's got the carcasses. They could certainly look at the and see if there's any blood in the eardrums and test that hypothesis.
Talk to us though about big numbers of birds in flight. I mean, to me, that a kind of enormous flock swirling through the sky is one of the most mesmerizing things you can possibly watch. And what I've always marveled at is, like fish, when they're in flight in these huge numbers, very close together and twirling and whirling in a big mass, they don't run into each other. So why are they running into, you know, post office boxes, mailboxes in the middle of the night?
You're right. That is that phenomenon of seeing those huge flocks of birds flying together is really
fantastic.
Awesome. But they can see each other, and birds are mostly visual animals, and so they're trying to keep their space. They're trying to stay near the other birds, but yet keep their own appointed space away from the birds. And this is like, I mean, imagine you were asleep in bed and somebody throws an M80 in there and a big explosion happens and you run out in the dark.
And bump into
you can stub your toe and do all that. So you can imagine the sort of situation. If you're in a dorm or something, there'd be a lot of other people running around too in the dark. Now, the birds, when they come out of there, they're not only can't they see and they're scared and confused, they are flying and they have to stay flying. You have to stay moving at a certain speed to stay airborne. And so these guys are moving along at a pretty good clip in the dark, flying all by themselves, and they can't see to get the correct spacing between the neighbors. It'd be like, I don't know, a marching band suddenly woken up in the middle of the night.
And go.
They know how to march together, but they're panicky and they just are bumping into each other.
Is it really all visual? I've always wondered about the physics of that fabulous flock flight. They're just individually all watching the you know, 16 flying birds around them within the 1,600 or 16,000. And is that like bats, radar, or sonar or anything. It's just visual?
It seems to be. Yep. There have been a number of new studies that have come out recently, done some very creative work with flying birds. And, yeah, there doesn't seem to be any sort of extra stuff going on. And you can – they are very visual. They have very good reflexes, and so they can respond very fast. And they're good at it.
Karen, I know from the autopsies or necropsies, as you call it, that you've done so far, you've seen, trauma on the breasts of the birds and the heads on the birds. I guess that lines up with the theory here, just plowing into stuff.
That's correct. According to the pathologist, if the birds would have simply just fallen from the sky and had not run into objects and trees and such, the birds would have shown trauma on the backs, other portions of the body, rather than the leading edges of the body, which indicated that they collided with stationary objects.
Greg Butcher, last word's going to go to you here. So here, maybe we've got a phenom and a, you know, wild, quirky situation. In general, how are birds doing in this country? Bird populations up, down, steady? You know, what's the bird health in America?
Well, you see a real variety of things. We've got a number of very common birds that are declining. And interestingly enough, red-winged blackbirds is one of the common birds that is declining, perhaps because of the persecution, because these large roosts are unpopular, and they're unpopular because they affect agriculture. Mm-hmm. So there are some common birds in decline. There's a number of rare species that we're very concerned about, things like the lesser prairie chicken or the greater sage grouse, where their habitat is really under threat. From a variety of reasons. And then there are a few birds that are expanding. So we've got birds like the Eurasian collared dove and the Canada goose and the snow goose, whose populations are expanding. But in general, it's the more specialized birds that we're more concerned about, and the more generalized species tend to be, and the ones that can accept human environments that tend to be expanding in space.
Well, you three are great to give us this mini-seminar today. Greg Butcher with the National Audubon Society. Thank you very much for joining us today, Greg.
Great to be here.
Kevin McGowan at Cornell, thanks so much. Keep that ornithology going, Kevin.
Thanks. You're most welcome. It's fun to be here.
And Karen Rowe in Humphrey, Arkansas. Thank you so much and good luck there, Karen.
Thank you. We're going to continue to search for answers and rule out things that did not contribute to this problem.
Good. Appreciate your time. In a moment, a big medical journal calls the doctor who touted a vaccine autism link a fraud. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. For a decade now, a claimed link between a children's vaccine and autism has been a charged, fraught issue. Now, a top British medical journal says the research that famously made that link was fraudulent. It's a bombshell that leaves autism researchers still searching. We're going to look at the news and autism research now. You can join us. What do you make of the charge that deliberate fraud is behind this big debate? We're online at onpointradio.org and on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The link has been made much of. Celebrity Jenny McCarthy, a vocal autism activist whose son was diagnosed with autism, has helped spread the message against vaccine using Dr. Andrew Wakefield's research as ammunition. Here's a little bit of that.
Without a doubt in my mind, I believe vaccinations triggered Evan's autism. You know, environmental toxins play a role. Viruses play a role. Those are all triggers. But vaccines play the largest role right now.
That's what Jenny McCarthy says. But the British Medical Journal commissioned a big investigative effort into this and came out with their headline, how the case against the MMR vaccine was fixed. It appears online today at the BMJ, British Medical Journal website. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. The doctor who did the research was Andrew Wakefield, and the charge is that he doctored the research to make the connection. Last night on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360, he said he's been the target of a conspiracy.
What this is a ruthless, pragmatic attempt to crush any investigation into valid vaccine safety concerns. Not just my concerns. I'm here at a meeting of experts on vaccines from around the world who are extremely concerned about the safety of vaccines and the damage that they believe and I believe is being done.
Well, we've lost our connection to the investigative reporter in London. We'll try and make that happen here, but we've got a couple of doctors with us who are pretty plugged in. From Boston, Dr. Rula Shueri is with us, neurodevelopmental pediatrician at the Floating Hospital for Children at Tufts Medical Center, where she focuses on autism and autism spectrum disorders. Dr. Shueri, thank you very much for being with us here.
Thank you for having me.
And with us from Cleveland, Ohio, is Mac Widznitzer. He's professor of pediatric neurology at Case Western Reserve University. Professor Max, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So first to this news out of the United Kingdom. Are you taking it on face value? They did an investigation. They're saying very plainly this was fraudulent, sort of doctored research. How are you receiving that? Max Wissner, let me come first to you, if I may.
Okay. I basically, the facts seem to fit. We already know that there was unethical behavior, that the research study was not done according to what was claimed it was to be done. We know that monies were exchanged and that there was that there were lawyers in the background that had not been identified as part of the research. So it is not a major leap to basically state that also the data would be changed in order to fit what was going on. And I think Brian Deer, the reporter, leaves some good documentation. He documents every claim he has from records or from interviews that he's done. This is not just coming off the top of his head.
We're supposed to be speaking with Brian Deer, but he's not with us at the moment. The report includes, and you may know this, Dr. Shueri, that Andrew Wakefield was paid $750,000 by lawyers looking to sue the MMR, mumps, measles, rubella vaccine. I guess the suggestion, or more than a suggestion, is that he took the money and doctored the evidence. What's your reaction, Dr. Shueri?
Well, I mean, I did also review the reports, and if I go back to the initial, you know, publication of Dr. Wakefield, so it was also only on 12 children. This was never replicated. So even before it was retracted by the Lancet, even before all these, you know, charges, and there definitely has not been replication in the scientific committee, in the scientific, you know, field. We do not believe that there is an association between MMR and autism. And the fact that this study now is more in the news in light of these new charges, and I mean, this will probably bring on more controversy because there is a big community that still believes that there is a link, although the proof and all the studies and all the results out there do not show that there is any link. Vaccines do not cause autism.
Max Wissner, help us with that, because this purported link, this once-claimed link, now apparently debunked as fraud, but it took on a huge life of its own in public. I mean, we heard Jenny McCarthy, but she was by no means alone. Many parents responded to this by avoiding the MMR vaccine. You've got people in public health saying, you know, that's a tragedy if people avoided that now on the basis of something that was made up kind of out of thin air. How have you seen public opinion and scientific opinion, I don't know, stay lined up or separate on this over the years since this was first asserted?
Well, if you look at individuals, it's only a small group of vocal individuals who really continue to make these claims. While many families may be concerned because of the false claims that are being made about this purported link between autism and vaccines, the vast majority get reassured when they discuss this and are able to get facts in a true sense from individuals who actually know the facts and are able to represent them in an unbiased manner. When you look at the claims that are being made here, there's no biologic basis for how this event can occur. We know that children with autism frequently are recognized at age 18 to 21 months, around the time period that the MMR vaccine is given, and therefore people are now taking a temporal, or basically because two events occur at the same time, and trying to imply that there's a causal association that one caused the other. All you really have is just two things happening. Many times there's going to be history of events happening beforehand. The scientific community, for the most part, and the vast majority of individuals understand this because there's been at least 13 to 14 studies that have been unable to support this original claim. And in the parent community, while there are still some people who believe, and in my opinion, will continue this belief despite whatever facts you may come down to provide them, the vast majority of individuals are willing to listen to individuals who give them information and will be able to study the information and come to their own conclusions.
It's really interesting. David Amaral at the University of California, Davis, saying what's most destructive in an episode like this is the undermining of the public's confidence in the integrity of science. Of course, over 90% of school-aged children, we read, have been vaccinated against mumps, measles, rubella. It's a CDC report. But mumps are still the second highest reported disease among all vaccine-preventable diseases out there. We've got callers with questions. We're very glad you two are with us. Patrick in Matthews, Virginia. Patrick, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are we doing today?
Pretty well. What's your question, Patrick?
Well, my question is if it's absolutely fraudulent, then why did they change the serums to where they have less mercury in them? Autism does create symptoms in children that mercury does.
Well, let me answer this. That's a simple one.
Good.
The
Thank
measles,
you.
Mumps, rubella vaccine never contained a mercury preservative. Mercury preservative is only used in what we call dead virus or dead bacterial vaccines. But when you have a live virus in a vaccine, you can't have a preservative that would kill it. So MMR never contained mercury at all. The reason mercury was removed was because people worried about the public perception.
Mercury removed from where, if it was never in
it
the...
It was removed from things like the DTP, now the DTAP, and various other vaccinations. It was removed in order to enhance public confidence, and because here in America, that extra protection is no longer needed because of the ways that we basically make the vaccines and store the vaccines. But MMR never contained mercury.
Let's go to Sophia in Boston. Sophia, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you.
What do you know, Sophia?
Oh, well, I just wanted to say that, you know, I work in early intervention, and I work...
You work in what, autism intervention with parents, families?
Yes, from birth to three, and I'm often asked about the link between autism and the MMR vaccine, and I think this is such an important topic to be discussing because so many families are starting to look to the internet as opposed to look to the experts for the truth and for advice.
So do you see parents reluctant to have their children vaccinated? I mean, overwhelmingly they do, but do you see parents who worry about it?
Yes, I do see parents who either hold off for longer periods of time or try or want to do to get the vaccinations in a different in a different order or just get them one at a time over a longer period of time.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Sophia. Rula Shueri, what about it? Do you see people going... I mean, lots of people do go to the internet for information about all kinds of things here, and people have, you know, a new young child. They see the prevalence of autism out there these days. They want to do the right thing, but are they coming up with misinformation?
Yes, definitely. And we I have everyday families who ask me questions about immunizations, about vaccines in general, whether this is their first child who is being diagnosed with autism, or this is a sibling of a child already diagnosed with autism. And I have few families who have chosen not to immunize their younger child, their younger, you know, sibling, because of the fear that this will trigger autism. And, I mean, this is definitely the result of misinformation. What's important to remember is that immunizations are there for a reason, and it's the disorders that they protect us against can be really dangerous in themselves. And there were recent outbreaks of whooping cough that can be detrimental in newborns or in older, you know, children. And the eradication of diseases like polio was because of the immunization. So if parents stop immunizing their children because of this unfounded, scientifically unfounded relation between vaccines and autism, we will start seeing more disorders, more diseases that have been eradicated and that can be more dangerous and more prevalent than autism.
No, I understand, more prevalent, all that, but yet autism, if you believe there's a link, and, you know, people have, apparently on fraudulent research, but if you believe it, you know, people try to take action. John in Richmond, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello to your guests. One thing I haven't heard is people describe autism as autism spectrum disorders.
Yes.
I'm a parent of a child on the spectrum.
Okay.
And what I've learned in the past 4 years since his diagnosis is that if you've met one person on the spectrum, you've met one person on the spectrum.
You mean everybody's different?
Well, it runs the gamut from people who are profoundly affected, nonverbal, to people who are able to function fairly normally in society with specific, you know, social deficits or whatever. What we've found is that the expertise is not always apparent where the expertise is.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are left to look, read voluminously, talk to primary care physicians, talk to specialists, you respond to symptoms. And it's not always a holistic approach. It's a kind of, oh my gosh, he's doing this, what do we do now? And I think it's great that the facts are bearing out on the vaccines, but in lieu of a concerted approach to look at multiple symptoms, multiple causes, and rule in or rule out based on hard facts, that we're going to have this because people are going to talk. Say, well,
right.
You know, what worked for you? Jenny McCarthy is just doing what any parent was doing. Her soapbox is just a lot bigger than mine.
Yeah, John, I wish the best to your child and your family there. And I'm going to pick up this whole big issue of research. I want to get one more call first and sort of pulling it together so people can understand. But one more. San Diego, California, Carrie is on the line. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air.
I was just calling because I'm familiar with Wakefield's debunked study, and I was wondering if the panelists today, my son's 12, and he's been diagnosed with autism.
Okay.
We've had the diagnosis for about 6 years. And I know from other parents that vaccine injuries are legitimate. And maybe our experts today could talk a little bit to listeners about the difference between the two and how sometimes a vaccine injury gets blanketed into this.
What do you mean by vaccine injury, Carrie?
Well, there are families whose children have won lawsuits where there has been a link established between a vaccine and the
and autism or something else.
Autism. Well, some people believe that that autism is just a part of neurodiversity, and so what you see as symptoms of autism are maybe not autism. There's a different name. But there are children who have reactions to, but there are such anomalies, and they're not the relationship between these children and their injuries and their vaccines are flukes.
I think we've got it, and our time is limited. I want to pick it up here. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio, and Dr. Wisnitzer. All right, there's the concern about, you know, sometimes do vaccines sometimes hurt kids? I guess some must.
There's no doubt about that. There are adverse events. There are problems that can occur with vaccines. There are things kids can have, seizures provoked by the fever from vaccines. There's rare situations where you can have Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a nerve paralysis. There are claims with some of the older vaccines of prolonged changes in mental status.
But these are risks we take for the whole society and so our kids don't get measles and whooping cough and all the rest.
That's it. And that is why the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program was developed, because we understand that for the greater societal good, we have to vaccinate in order to protect people.
So set that aside for a moment, because we just got 2 minutes. Why do we have so much autism then? If it's not this, what is going on here and where does research stand?
Do you want me to answer?
Yes, please.
Well, because, number one, we've expanded the definition. We're including kids that we never included in the past. The research is basically telling us that there's prenatal onset. In other words, it's something that happens that affects brain development in utero in the vast majority of the kids. We've demonstrated genetic reasons. There are environmental factors that people are reporting. And I think we're getting better at identifying these kids than we were 20 years ago. So there's a myriad of reasons. I can also tell you about the parent age when the children are born that may be a factor that's involved. There's many other factors that are involved. We don't have to postulate something, the disproven link between vaccines and autism.
Rula Shueri, is there something that we can ultimately do to guard against autism? Will there be a vaccine for autism itself, or is that just impossible?
Yeah, I wish no. I mean, so far, there is a lot of research. The research is very active, as Dr. Wisnitzer was mentioning. We do believe that there is a genetic predisposition already from the moment that, you know, the fetus is being developing. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, there is some environmental trigger that causes this genetic predisposition to appear. What's very perplexing to everybody is that a third of kids later diagnosed with autism have this period of regression that can happen around the first and second year of life. And that is around the time when they get their immunization. So this is why this was started in the first place.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is where we need a lot of research.
Well, a charge of fraud early. There and medicine and families still, working? Often struggling with this one. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us. Dr. Rula Shueri at the Floating Hospital for Children at Tufts Medical Center. Thank you very much, Dr. Shueri.
Thank you.
And Max Wisnitzer at the Case Western Reserve University there in pediatric neurology. Dr. Wisnitzer, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This is On Point.